is Daniel Garber-Luis for CulturalMining.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. What do vintage wine, comic book superheroes, bison burgers, rap music, survival techniques, sea monsters, and the Calgary Stampede all have in common? Well, nothing at all at first glance, but dig a little deeper and you'll find they're all tied to and parts of contemporary Indigenous life, a culture that's being reclaimed, rejigged, and rebooted even as we speak, while the rest of the world is just starting to go native. Going Native is also the name of a new 13-part TV series that covers a wide range of topics. From gourmet food to pop culture storytelling to spiritualities, it's slick, it's funny, fast-moving, and always surprising. The series is produced, co-written, and hosted by Drew Hayden Taylor, the widely known Indigenous novelist, playwright, columnist, and humorist. It's having its world premiere on APTN on May the 8th. And I'm very pleased to have here with me, from Curve Lake, Ontario, Drew Hayden Taylor to tell us more about Going Native. Hi, Drew. Thanks so much for this digital meeting. But before we start, let's get the name out of the way. Wasn't Going Native a sort of a derogatory term used to describe like British colonials adopting an Indigenous way of life in a foreign country? How come you chose that for the title?
Well, the technical term is actually going Indian.
Uh-huh.
Going Native is actually the more politically correct term. A couple of years ago when we were sort of beginning to develop the idea, and of course in this day and age we'd probably be going Indigenous, but the more technically correct it becomes, the less it has more of that visceral meaning involved with it. So we decided to sort of meet halfway and use the term going Native. So it's more incorrect than derogatory.
Okay. Well, it's a 13-part series, and in each half-hour episode, you manage to visit like three far-flung places all across North America, like Navajo Nation, BC, Alberta, Manitoba, often revisiting places in more than one episode. So it seems to me to have involved a huge amount of travel and preparation. Was the entire series planned and scripted in advance before the shooting started?
No, in some cases, some was obviously planned and prepared and contacted and everything went according to plan. But frequently when you're making documentary films, you fly by the seat of your pants. And in several different situations, we had things fall through and we had to make do with something in that area. When we were in, I think it was Washington State, that we were going to do the Indian Fast Horse races, but that fell through and we were already there, so we had to make up something. And luckily, as the gods would have it, we ended up doing a piece on the traditional fishing habits of the Yakima Indians.
The pole fishing.
All hovered over that gorge, fishing out salmon with nets. And that was God-given. It was so amazing to watch and be a part of. So it was about 50-50, I would say.
One thing I found really interesting was the segment about the so-called Ogopogo monster in the Okanagan Lake that you're retelling, where the people you talk to completely turns the popular concepts upside down. What did you find out?
It's not a monster. It's a sort of a beloved spirit that protects the lake.
Yeah. And who told this to you? How did you find out?
A woman who works at the cultural center. Her name escapes me. We did this like a year and a half ago.
Right.
But she took us down to the lake, showed us the lake, and explained through storytelling just who Ogopogo was. And I don't think Ogopogo is the actual name of the water spirit, but sort of its connection to the people, to the land, to the other animals. It was actually quite lovely, and it's just, as you said, it's completely counterpoint to the concept of a big freshwater sea monster.
Another surprise is when you talk about the area
around the Elbow River, which is featured at the Calgary Stampede, and you described it as a case of cowboys helping Indians. What was that all about?
Well, one of the weird things about the, as you may or may not know about Canadian history, is Native people were once banned and barred from practicing their culture, their language, their spirituality, basically everything. They were the government and society wanted them to be nice little white people, all except for that little corner of the country. Because they were doing the Calgary Stampede, they wanted to have, there's lots and lots of cowboys, but somebody surmised that you can't have cowboys without Indians. Tourists want to see the Indians, so they got special exemption from the federal government to allow the Kainai, the Stoney, etc., to dress up in traditional regalia, live in teepees on the ground, and help participate in this huge tourist activity. And it's one of the few cases where the government gave in and allowed Native people to be Native. Of course, it was for the benefit of the white people, but you have to take what you can get.
And How about from you? What did you find most surprising about the series?
Oh, we'd be here all day.
Okay.
On a personal level, I had this, you know, I'm already well-traveled. Prior to this series, I'd been to about 130 First Nation communities across Canada and the United States. And after this series, I mean, you know, I had another 20 or 30 that I had never been to, plus a whole whack that I'd been to previously. And I just got to see the variety of peoples, of places, of activities, of culture across this country and into the States. while I was working on it, I was just honored and privileged to be a part of this production, provide a window into these people's cultures, and just to see the many myriad facets of Indigenous life across this country. And I was privileged, and I still am privileged to see all this.
Most documentaries these days on Indigenous topics or themes are, for very good reason, serious, and they're often angry. But Going Native is light and breezy and upbeat. Why the difference?
Well, I've always been critical of that. I mean, as a playwright and a novelist, etc., a lot of the literature coming out of the First Nations communities is frequently dark, depressing, bleak, sad, and angry. And that's because when an oppressed people get their voice back, they're going to write about being oppressed. And it's always been my personal belief that it's been our sense of humor, our wonder at the world, that it's allowed us to survive, you know, 300, 400, 500 years of colonization. So I've always been, I don't know the terminology, I just have always celebrated and embraced the Indigenous sense of humor and outlook on life. So in a lot of my writing and a lot of the filmmaking, I like to support a more positive and upbeat perspective on Indigenous life. There are other writers who are much better than me that deal with the more, I don't know, dysfunctional aspect of the First Nations community, whereas I like to be much more positive in my exploration.
And so, speaking again of you as a writer, so as you're a novelist and a playwright, storytelling is part and parcel of your work and your life. And as a member of the Anishinaabe Curved Lake First Nation, storytelling is also part of your heritage. Do these two strands ever meet? Do you combine the two aspects of storytelling together?
Oh, it's impossible not to. I mean, when I lecture, I frequently talk about how I'm what you might call a contemporary storyteller. When I talked with traditional storytellers, they would tell me when I was young in my career that we need the new stories as much as we need the old stories. So I always took that to heart and kept that in mind when I was writing whatever I was writing. And the fact that this is the 21st century, And in the 21st century, there's so many interesting ways to tell stories, right? Storytelling used to be all oral, and then it was written down, and then it went into theater, went into radio, went into television, went into movies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that now, in the 21st century, there's so many unique ways to tell stories. Even video games have detailed and lengthy narratives within them to support the game-playing process.
And speaking of video games, there are native video game creators. Can you talk about the role video games can play within Indigenous life and vice versa?
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's a festival here in Toronto called Imaginative, and one of the things they incorporate is video games and virtual reality.
Yeah.
Where they combine the two and they show what Indigenous people are doing in those particular areas and those particular games. And so we had the opportunity to see up-and-coming Indigenous gamers developing their work and also developing the reality shows. And it's just amazing to see how we're taking our original narratives as an oral culture and putting them in this three-dimensional environment to the point where I feel very, very old being around these people. There's so much more generation past me that I just sort of say, go do your thing, kids.
So you're the host of the show and Indigenous yourself, but you have to go to all these. You're saying how it's very, very diverse. Indigenous culture is anything but a single monolith. So when you present yourself in front of the TV camera, you sort of come across somewhat as a naive outsider insider. Can you talk about, I don't know if you can talk about, but is the image, your image as the host, is it identical to yourself?
To a certain extent, we did another documentary a few years ago about the German preoccupation with North American Aboriginal culture. It was called Searching for Winnetou, and it was incredibly successful on CBC. And I've done 19 lecture tours of Germany. I've been to Germany practically once a year.
Wow.
Talking about Indigenous culture, because Germans, they have powwows, they have plays, all these things. They're very infatuated with Indigenous culture, but it's Indigenous culture they perceive still exists in the 1880s.
Huh.
So for the context of that particular documentary, I had to pretend that I was going in search of this information, of these people. But the truth having been, I'd been there, like, you know, as I said, 15, 16 times before we went there with the film crew. And I already pretty much knew most of the stuff that we were discovering, and I'm using air quotes here. With a show like this, much like what I think you told me, a lot of the stuff I knew, and a lot of the stuff, excuse me, a lot of the stuff I had was new to me too. I've been to places I've been before, but I was in new places I hadn't been. I'm learning stuff about horses I never knew existed, because my people aren't a horse people. My people are a canoe people, and I'm still discovering stuff about canoes. There are about four or five situations where I was placed in a canoe, and I, even though I come from a canoe people, I am not a natural canoeist, so that was somewhat embarrassing. So, yeah, when you spend this much time and effort and go to the locations where we went, you can't help but soak up all of the culture, all of the information that wouldn't be available to you that you might find out in a book or another documentary.
Well, as a viewer, I superficially anyway, I was able to soak up a lot too, that you were the trailblazer for presenting it. Thanks so much for talking with me.
No problem. Just let me say, this was so much fun to do. We're so glad it's finally coming out, and we're starting work on season two.
Wonderful. No, I can't wait for that one. Thanks so much for talking with me, Drew.
No problem. My pleasure.
Drew Hayden Taylor's new TV series, Going Native, is premiering on May 8th on APTN. This is Daniel Garber, the Movies, each Friday morning on CIUT 89.5 FM and on my website, culturalmining.com.